very private, and one has to be very trustworthy. Very trustworthy. Mukti, tadati, kahiche, nasma, bhakti yoga. That means that Krishna easily gives mukti or liberation, but he doesn't easily give his bhakti yoga. Why? Because it is sudolava, because very rare, because he himself is controlled by it. So, the question that you had asked, that was very interesting, that's, which we all think and often don't have anyone to talk about it with. But why doesn't he just make it a lot easier? So, I was listening to something, a lecture of Sahuchamar that has now passed away, and it was on Vedic psychology. And there was a little segment, not little, it's about 12 minutes, that I thought I'd play. It's quite interesting. And it, he's talking about the difference between the mentality of a modern man and a pre-modern man, more or less the mentality that we have now and previous mentalities that people had. And because the question of why doesn't he just do it for me is the kind of thinking, and this is my conclusion on it, it's the kind of thinking that springs from the modern mind. And although in India the mind is quite different, this is mostly referring to the Western psyche. In India the mind is somewhat different, but as you were mentioning, especially in Bombay, where you don't have time to even think about why all these things are happening to you, you're just too busy working, and it's not accepted that your life is meant for everything being easy. There's something in the Western mind, the Western psyche, that you know, you have a natural right, you know, to be happy, and anything that gets in the way of your happiness, like the lack of God just going like this, poof, making you perfectly happy and spiritual, is a mistake and a problem, and it should be rectified. But the pre-modern mind, which is very similar to it's the way traditional people used to think, and it's, in my understanding, it's clearly more pious and more realistic too. It's very, very different, and that type of thinking doesn't quite spring to that type of a mind. So I'll just play it for you. It'll take me perhaps a moment to get it a bit organized. But I found it very interesting and speaks to this point. And we're plagued with this, you know, we're all products of this. So many intellectual arguments, and it doesn't really erase that thought from our consciousness, because it's just sitting in the basic way we think. Okay. I think it's about 12 minutes. Now, sometimes he speaks a little fast, and he quotes from an essay by someone.
So, modernity. I found on the internet a very interesting essay, which is written by an American professor, a Dutch name actually, Klaas Lin, and he's from the Catholic University in Washington, D.C. So he's written some very interesting things about modernity, the modern mentality. And he summarized modern mentality as a state of manic depression. Everyone's heard this term, manic depression, or it's called bipolar disorder. And even the World Health Organization says that depression is becoming the number one health problem in the world today, depression is extremely widespread. So this Professor Lin, he says, no wonder, because the very mentality of modernity, the very value system of modern civilization is manic depressive. And this goes along very, very well with our Vaishnava philosophy. Because why? Because of this understanding of the three modes of material nature. And as Prabhupada said so many times, the modern civilization is in the two lower modes, Rajagun, Tamagun. So Rajagun, what is that? That's passion, that's elation, that's feeling very, very overly self-confident, very fired up, very ready to go out there and, you know, satisfy all of my desires. Mania, in other words. One becomes manic in the mode of passion. Two, madly self-assertive. I'm going to conquer the world, you see. I'm going to become rich and famous. And then that is offset, this Rajasic mentality, with Tamasic mentality, in that one endeavors in a mode of passion for some time, is not able to reach one's goals, or even one does reach some of those goals, they're always threatened. You see, attaining these goals puts oneself in great anxiety to keep up on its own. And so this gradually brings about depression. Depression is symptomatic of the mode of ignorance. So, all of this, these modern values, mania and depression, they appear as diagnosed by psychology today. They appear out of a frame of reference, a general attitude of low, what's called low self-esteem. That when one is in the manic phase, one is trying to fill up the lack. One is feeling unfulfilled, and so he's working very hard to make something of himself. You see? Increase my bank accounts, increase my importance in society, increase whatever. And then I become someone. So this is called, by some psychologists, covert depression. It's actually depression, but it's covert, it's hidden. It looks like he's got a big smile, and he's working very hard, but around the edge there's desperation, you see. He's desperate too. He's actually running from this unfulfillment that's haunting him. Keep him busy. But then sooner or later the depression catches up with him, and then it becomes overt. It goes from covert to covert. So this is another way of saying manic depression or bipolar. So low self-esteem. We don't know who we are. So to come back to the Vaishnava Vedanta analysis, yes, in this materialistic civilization, we don't know who we are. We don't know that we're spirit soul. And when one comes to self-realization, what does Krishna say in the Gita? Prasanatma. One is fully satisfied. You see, one is satisfied in the knowledge that I am not this body, I am not this mind, I am eternal spirit soul. Nasyakshati na kamshati. There's no sense of lack, no anxiety that I need something, no lamentation that something is lost. You see? So actually we can identify this low self-esteem to ultimately mean lack of self-realization, lack of knowing who I really am as spirit soul. And this Professor Wynn, he points out that in what he calls pre-modern times, people were closer to this understanding of themselves as being non-material. I want to read from his essay, "The old classical and Christian outlook is deeply rooted. It has not entirely disappeared even today. Neither can we point to particular individuals in the modern world whose personalities are entirely clear-cut embodiments of a new, more imaginative momentum. All human beings contain both old and new. Much neurosis in contemporary society is intrinsic to the cultural dynamic under investigation. But additional anxiety and confusion are due to individuals harboring not only that dynamic, not only the modern conception, but they also have this older, too modern nature in them too. It's in conflict with the newer values. So Professor Zinn says that the pre-modern worldview was religious. The pre-modern person was aware of mankind's fallen state. That was just the way they looked at themselves and the world. They were in a fallen condition. It was accepted. Pre-modern man believed that he can be elevated by more intellectual effort and by divine grace. But he accepts that some limitation will always remain. But we are, just like we understand in our Vaishnava, we are very tiny, very small. Even if we become elevated to the spiritual platform, doesn't mean we become Krishna. Doesn't mean that there we can do anything we want, you see, because now I'm liberated. Mankind is not God. Pre-modern man therefore holds self-criticism to be a virtue. Suffering is not unexpected by him, nor does he resent it as undeserved. Well-being and happiness are not taken for granted, but are reasons to give thanks to God. Pre-modern man is acutely aware of his own weaknesses, because he measures himself by high moral standards that lead away from the conception of the self as an enjoyer. The ethics of Aristotle and Cicero are ascetic. Christ's Sermon on the Mount is otherworldly. Pre-modern man accepts that his moral shortcomings are his own. He and he alone is responsible for improving his character. Problems in life are seen as the consequences of moral failure. To solve problems, he should strain his utmost to better his character. And even if he makes some progress, plenty of imperfections will remain, requiring yet more effort. And also he points out that in olden times, society was knitted together by the perception that our neighbor's problems are our own. That's a very important point. You see, pre-modern person was not focused on the individual. It was at a very social outlook. Sharing these points that we just heard. Then Professor Lin talks about modern man, modern attack.
The first thing is, so pre-modern man, he's saying, he's feeling very lowly and fallen, and he's suffering, and he thinks, well, it's because I'm a fallen soul, and I deserve to suffer. And I'm not alone in this. Everyone else is in the same condition. It's not just thinking of this me. Me is the individual. And personal. So people used to think, I don't only deserve good to happen. I deserve difficulties because look at who I am. And then when something good happens, you think, oh, that's the grace of God. So that's, he's saying, and it's very, very socially oriented too. And if you see your neighbor having problems or the people in your village or community, you see that as your problem too, or your family. So now he's going to contrast that with modern man. And this is from an essay by some professor who's quite a famous historian.
Very interesting. His demeanor is very different from that of pre-modern man. Far from discounting the opportunities of a worldly existence, this person entertains great expectations. Francis Bacon was only one of the first to believe in endless progress. He thought that with the disappearance of old superstitions and a full application of the methods of experimental science, a vastly improved human existence would be possible. The Enlightenment extended these expectations. The hope for a new and better world was not necessarily based on faith in science and reason. The most fundamental longing, the fundamental behind scientism itself, was for a basic transformation of human existence, for a great liberation, expansion, and deepening, making life infinitely more satisfying.
Based on me and my abilities, and all that's holding me back is my desire, and if I want it enough, I can do everything. I can go to the moon. I can be the moon. I can whatever. I can do it. I can do it. I can go back to God and He should, and I deserve it. You just gotta believe in yourself. And these pretty modern. Superstitious, I'm a fool and this and that, come on. This is what's holding everyone back. Yes, this is a problem. And this is exactly what complex criticized. This is what goes on in India. All this old stuff, this is what's holding back us as a country. This caste stuff and this and that and this belief in God and all the rituals. This is what's holding us back. We can become the greatest country. We can become the greatest. We are the greatest. We have the greatest past. We are the greatest in the present. We are the greatest, the future is ours. Sounds like that Harani Kashi poop show. Okay, more about it. Now he's going to talk about the seeds of this modern mentality. He's going to talk about Rousseau. Who was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, French-Swiss. This is the history of the Western mentality like that, and it affects the whole world.
That an early, prominent example of one who believed that classical and Christian civilization was based on a profound misconception. We also believe that the resulting oppression can be ended and that mankind can achieve a new, superior existence. So this modern mentality is a kind of intoxication with the present and with the future. One is looking ahead, one is believing completely in progress, in the abilities of man to better his existence, and one is actually seeing religious attitude and the philosophies of the past, morality, to stand in the way. You see, they're holding us back. They're saying that, no, we are limited, no, we're not God, we cannot become God, no, this has to be swept off the stage. All your old ideas have to be torn down, and when man can just exert his powers freely without all the hindrances of the past.
The universe is ours.
Then, as they actually expect a new age. Of course, now we have new age in a context many people today think of it as some kind of new spiritual horizon. But this term new age has been with us quite some time. The communists, the Marxist Leninists, used to talk about the new age, the communist age. They even used to talk about a new man, transformed man, Homo Sovieticus, I called him. I'm serious. They thought that the result of communist principles being established in society, the human being would change, would become a different species. Adolf Hitler and the Nazis had a very similar idea. But with the purification of the racial lines, that a new type of Superman would appear. And this idea of new age, it goes back. It goes back at least to one person mentioned here by Rousseau, who lived back in the 1700s. And we can read about him. Swiss-French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who lived from 1712 to 1778, was the founding father of Romanticism. Romanticism was a reaction to the so-called Enlightenment project, which was a French school of rationalism in the 1600s and 1700s. Rationalism means any doctrine that teaches the supremacy of the human intellect over all other considerations. The French philosophers of the Enlightenment, like Diderot, D'Alembert, Lemaître, Condillac, Helvetius, so on and so forth, they propagated a vision of the rational society, But there are rules to people's appetite for science, abstraction, and impersonal reason. Creeping dissatisfaction with sterile intellectualism burst out as a revolt that we now call the Romantic Movement. The Romantics rediscovered art, mystery, and irrationality. And they rediscovered emotions. In fact, they elevated emotion to a position that had never before held in the history of Western thought. Rousseau paid much service to emotion-soaked virtues of compassion, friendliness, loving-kindness, but his own character was undisciplined. He was actually shockingly deficient in truthfulness, purity, and honesty. Other philosophers of his time, who were sympathetic at first to his message, soon soured as they came to know the dark side of Rousseau's personality. Human Voltaire dismissed Rousseau as a monster. Diderot called him a deceitful, vain as Satan, ungrateful, cruel, hypocritical, and full of malice. A woman with whom Rousseau was intimate summed him up as an interesting madman. About Rousseau, Paul Johnson writes in a book called Intellectuals, Chapter 1, he was the prototype of that characteristic figure of the modern age, the angry young man. Rousseau brought together three salient characteristics of the modern Promethean. One was the assertive delight to reject the existing order in its entirety, to reject everything. So, nonsense. Two, confidence in his capacity to refashion it from the bottom in accordance with principles of his own devising. And three, he had faith that this could be achieved by the political process. And not in the least, he celebrated the huge part of artistic intuition and impulse playing human conduct. He was very, very fascinated with his own imagination. He lived in his own imagination. And so he's one of these persons who just asks, why not? You see, why can't we change the whole world? By our own desires, our own plans. So, with this attitude, then naturally in his life, Rousseau ran into much opposition.
Anyway, it goes on. That's basically, we're all products of this modern mind, where we think the universe is mine, you know, for the asking, and for us, you know, trying to be devotees, the spiritual world is mine, I deserve it, after all, you know. For all I've done, you know, like I deserve it, and why doesn't he just bring me there? So how do you get rid of your own mind like that? But it's actually, if we examine what we're talking about a little bit, and the purity and the confidence and the love that one has to have to actually be in the most intimate, the highest position in relationship with Krishna, we know better than anyone else why not. Why he doesn't do it. So the question is, why doesn't he just bring us there and make it easy for me? After all, here I am. You know, I already said I want to go back to that once or whatever. You know, and I sort of didn't mention it at that time. So why doesn't he do it? After all, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this type of arrogance is the mentality of the modern man. It's very arrogant, actually. But it doesn't feel like it because I'm a person. It doesn't feel it. It feels just what's completely natural, unfortunately. So it goes back to, if we actually want to be with Krishna, Krishna will bring us back to him. Because it's ultimately his grace that does do that. And he doesn't wait till we're fully deserving. And because that will never happen. But we have to do our part in a completely desirous, fully sincere, and eager way. And then, when he so desires, as the independent Supreme Personality of God, he will do his part. So we should do our part and leave his part to him. That's the conclusion. Okay, that's what I wanted to. I thought it was interesting and had some relevance. Because what I saw is that this way of thinking, this way of thinking is completely natural. Those type of thoughts are completely natural for this way of thinking. And no matter what intellectual, rational, philosophical, scriptural reasons that are given, it doesn't really penetrate into the core of the heart where we cease asking the question and are satisfied. Rather, we keep thinking, I do deserve it. So therefore, why doesn't he do it? Why doesn't he do it? After all, he loves me. It's like, I remember the reading one time a description of the father of a European Irish poet, I think it was Yeats, who came to the United States back in the 1800s or something, 1900s, and he was so amazed. He said, "What kind of place is this? In Europe, the children do austerities to satisfy their parents, and in this place, the parents do austerities to satisfy the children." And that's, isn't that what everyone thinks? The children, they live at home nowadays. They'll live at home until they're 35 or 40 years old because they don't have to pay rent. They never think of what they're supposed to do for them. You know, that they have a true obligation until they're older, mature, very mature. They don't think they have an obligation to their parents. They think their parents owe them everything. And when they're older, they take out a long list of all the things that their parents didn't do properly for them. So this, worse because the society gets worse. So it's just a everything in Kali Yuga very quickly goes upside down. There's such an actual dangerous degree. And everyone, it's quite amazing that you can ask anyone, practically speaking, are we making progress? And everyone will say, yes, we're making progress. And that's just the modern mentality. We're making progress. And Prabhupada was so critical of this. He said, what progress have we made? What progress have we made? Are people more happy? Are they feel more secure nowadays? Before, people didn't have to travel to work. They would work in their outside in their village or in the farm. They wouldn't have to travel for an hour to work every day or something like that. The children would be with their parents all day long. And they would be so secure, and they would naturally grow into their profession of what their parents were doing and things like that. It wasn't the fear of losing your house and everything when the stock market crashes. There wasn't fear of continuous thieves all the time. You know, if you go even practically even in the villages in India, I don't know about today, but even some years ago, people didn't have doors, but to speak of locks on their doors, and they weren't worried either. And even when I was growing up, and that was in New York, we didn't lock our door at night.
Even here, early 70s, people used locks. Yeah. And everybody knew the keys in the
or under the doormat.
Under the mat. When I arrived here, I saw all these things myself. And there were no security screens here.
No.
In fact, yes.
Yeah.
It came later on.
Yeah. And they used to deliver milk in the early mornings,
yeah,
in horse-drawn carts in the 70s. And they would leave this milk outside the door in these bottles. this much was Kriman Tat. And no one could steal it. And you'd hear the horse clippity-clop, clippity-clop going down the street early in the morning.
Wasn't it a bit boring? I mean, like, you didn't have any of this. Now, I can communicate with people all over the world.
Yeah.
And when I want something, you know, I can, like, I can find a place somewhere in the world and get that thing.
Yeah.
Now, these poor people, they were so limited in their opportunities.
Yeah. Poor things. And they had no anxiety, practically speaking. Not an anxiety. It would be quite a relief the way I feel right now. It's interesting. I wouldn't know if it would be boring because I don't experience it ever. Yeah, well, that's the point. That's what the manic depressive, that's what he said. That the professor he characterized contemporary society as manic depressive. It's exemplary, it's being controlled completely by passion and ignorance. So it goes up, you're completely stimulated, and then you fall on your face. You have all kinds of hopes and beliefs, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, and then you find something, they advertise one person who actually did it, he won the lottery, and then all the rest of the people throw their money in and then become losers. So at that time, they were living in reality, maybe it was boring. And you know, when we looked at our parents' life, we thought how boring, like that. But now, people are so bored with all the progress that they can't live in reality for one moment even. How many times you have to download your emails a day? You know, you have 20 minutes or something like that. And your mobile phone, and you see people walking down the street, and no one is where they are. Yeah, I remember the first time I saw someone using one of those hands-free things. I thought that was the craziest thing, because this person was sitting there in the airport going, oh, there was no one there. Talking to anyone. I thought, wow, it's a new height of insanity. Yeah, especially in Asia, people. Well, now it's becoming more and more popular in Australia too. But everyone's got a mobile phone, and no one is where they are. They're always somewhere else. And even sitting down on a train or playing mobile games or computer games on their mobile phone, or texting people, or downloading mail, or surfing the net. You know, you just can't.
There have been new shows showing when you're collecting your luggage at the airport. You can collect your luggage and there's a TV program going on.
It's a complete continuous stimulation. That's the motor person, always stimulated.
Well, but they're going out for TV now.
So people are so stimulated, no wonder they're bored, because how can life live up to, all these action things? So, of course, they're going to be just simply bored and just dissatisfied with their life, so they have to take shelter of what? Illusion, intoxication, illusion, and fantasy. Just completely living, I've just won the War of Worlds or something like that. Imagining I'm a superhero with this huge body and I'm kicking and this and that and pushing this button with Guitar Hero. What is that called? Guitar? Guitar, is that what it's called, right? Yeah, and you just move your mobile phone and it makes all these sounds. And then there's another one called Grant. Yeah, and Grand Theft. There's another one about you can become a great criminal. This is one of the most popular games. great criminal. So you look what's happening to people's minds. So Prabhupada, earlier, Sir Hoshin Raj was talking about how he said that, Prabhupada said, the fault of material life is mental speculation. So that sounds so funny, in one sense. But he was showing how everyone nowadays, because of society being in the mode of passion, basically, is living in their minds completely. And that's actually where all the sense pleasure really ultimately takes place anyway, the combination of the mental senses and the mind. It's all mental. The advertising, it's all putting everyone on the mental platform, just living in their minds. No one is in their bodies anymore. Even what to speak of being as a soul that can't even stay in their bodies.
America is the ringleader. Giving
all these new values. Poor India.
Prabhupada said that the hippie movement started from India.
And actually, as Sahasrara says, it's all actually Mayavad philosophy. Where did that start? Didn't start in New York. In New York.
All the new values coming from America.
I heard it.
I remember there's this one fellow that one devotee years ago. His name was Acharya. Yes. So he went to India. And somewhere he was in India, and he saw some sadhu, and he was smoking a chilla and this and that. So the sadhu said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "My name is Acharya." And there he was smoking away and everything like that. And in Vrindavan, like 70% of the people are like, you know, just sit there with their chillums, you know, in the forest, people in the farms. So anyway, so this person said, "Oh, you are. Your name is Acharya. I'm also Acharya." and then this person said, "Do you have sadhus in your country like me?" And he said, "Yes, but we call them hippies."
Everything started in India, but
he has
taken the good with the bad.
That shows how great India is.
Yes. Even airplanes. Yes. Every month. Yes, of course. Bangladesh, Biman. Yeah.
The thing that I was pointing out, the many people analysis, that with substance abuse, the more concentrated and potent substance is taken, what is it that increases the most?
Fear coming down. Yeah. Being that incredible stimulation. They become fully addicted to stimulation, but the result is the depression.
Yeah.
It's madness, yeah. It's all madness. It's Kali.
The psychologists become the most respected people.
The scientists.
Like
the scientists. Because they're the real, they're the ones who bring you your progress. Anyway, in that kind of a mind, a modern mind, the thoughts of are all obvious. But therefore, in previous ages, there was meditation as the method, and you have to have a peaceful mind for meditation. And then in less previous ages, there was sacrifice with the demigods would actually become a people that are too sinful nowadays. And then after that, there was demon worship as the method. People had to be so qualified and regulated and everything. So now, out of Krishna's mercy, the Yogi Dharma is the most simple of all possible things. It's just sing. At least you can sing.
Or if you can't sing, you can hear.
You have to, and you can't even, it takes effort to sing, but you don't even have to, it's not like you open your ears, you have to open your eyes to see, but you don't even have to open your ears, they're already open, so you can hear the holy names. And this Kali Yuga is very, it moves so quickly too, it moves so quickly.
Breaks the banks of Vedic culture to pieces. It's in the Bhagavatam, in the descriptions of autumn, is one of the analogies, the comparisons, talks about how the rivers flood and the banks of the fields break. And Srila Vishnu Chakravarti describes them. This is like in the Kali Yuga, how it breaks the banks of the Vedic culture.
Yeah.
He said this is an unfavorable.
Yeah. And yet, the demigods need to take birth in Kali Yuga. Because something that's very, very difficult to attain becomes easier, much easier. And Mahaprabhu, amazingly enough, is giving this most intimate. This most intimate relationship with the Supreme, with God, with the Paramishwara, with the Absolute Truth. So intimate to the most trusted positions to the most untrustworthy people. Just by chanting Krishna's name and serving the holy names.
The difficulty with the desire to go back to Godhead. Sort of like quickly, is I remember for myself one time in 1972, and Srila Prabhupada was staying in the Philippines, and he was upstairs in his room, and we had been in his company, which was very potent, and we were waiting for the evening program, and we came downstairs and happened to sit by the swimming pool in the Hotel Intercontinental.
Yeah.
And while we were sitting there, I was sipping an orange juice. And the swimming pool looked very pleasant and everything. And I remember sitting there and actually thinking how impatient I was to go back to Godhead. You know, it seemed like sometimes you talk to people and they just can't imagine they're going to be born again. They just have to get there. That by the end of this life, they have to get there. And I was feeling like that. And then it was as if kind of like a super soul question. But then I was going, I just have to. I have to get there. And then I asked myself, and then when you get there, what will you do? And sitting in this environment, it just came right up like a sort of a bubble comes up through water. I will enjoy.
Yeah.
It was so clear.
Boy, we can't get there.
Yeah, it just became so clear to me. Oh, because what will I do when I get there? Like this, you know, I come to see this Prabhupada. He's upstairs. I'm so fortunate. I'm with Prabhupada that I go downstairs and have a drink and sit by the pool because I'm enjoying myself.
So the point being is that the serving mood is what we really have to cultivate. And when the serving mood is mature, then we will be there. And, yeah. And even Sanatana Kamsa had no serving mood, and he was face to face with Krishna, and he didn't see anything. So if we were brought to Godhead, with this consciousness. Yeah.
Ask yourself this question, if Vrindavan is no different from Krishna in the body, and if we go there and live our lives there, then we achieve perfection. So why don't we do it?
There's a few reasons.
Yeah, not really. Because
offering us an option,
his port is down.
On my port?
Yes. So why don't we do it? Ask yourself. Because you are not really convinced.
I don't have enough money. I had enough money. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I had enough security, you know, stuff for all days. Because when I get old, I won't be able to earn money.
Yeah, there's this one lecture that talks about these people who work hard, and then they go to Vrindavan, they want to retire to Vrindavan, they leave their family and they make their racks and cars of rupees to their family, and they got an arrangement that you send me in those days. He said 250 rupees a month. And they make the racks and cars. Just trying to get to the bazaar from the ritual for that at this point. And then Prabhupada said, so if we leave everything to family and make 250 rupees a month for Krishna, then Krishna becomes 250 rupees for us.
Like I give that example, like therefore if Krishna, if you say, why doesn't Krishna just do everything? If he did, would you be any different?
Why doesn't he make it different? That's the point. Why doesn't he like, not only give me everything, but make all the changes in me that will make me completely the way he wants to me. And also I can keep my material attachments at the same time, because it's only a question of free will, then, you know, why doesn't he? I knew one devotee who really had a problem with it. He said, why did Krishna give us free will? Why did Krishna do that? Why didn't he just... So anything can become a servant. Anything become a servant, surrender.
Free will
and individuality in the same way.
I'm trying to be sometimes when people say these things, you know, just in general, as I, you know, was thinking of at that time, that they're really struggling to actually get free of the incredible weight of their material past activity, and they have such a small amount in their bank accounts of Krishna consciousness in their early years that they really can't feel any hope.
It's a faith issue.
Yeah, I think very much a faith issue.
And Prabhupada therefore would say so many times, you can go back to God in the fly, just count your 16 rounds of the day, simple formulas that just seem like that's easy to follow, I can do that, and I'll get this. So, something to give you the hope that you could ever overcome all the insanity in your mind.
Was that a question, or what was the question? The
question is, can it be that sometimes you need these things to easily sort of, misconception
almost
to just get from point A?
Sure. It's like for a child between the ages of 0 and 5, they have to have great security in their life and their parents, and they have to feel that they're the center of existence and that their parents are eternally their parents and their house is their house. And all these things, which are illusory, it's not true, but they need those. The illusory securities, so when they grow up, the stability of consciousness to be able to face the instability of the world. Yes?
So what do you do for a child who's had the exact opposite? They're more than a child, and they've had the opposite.
Yes, it's not easy to overcome the poor conditioning. So Mahaprabhu said, you take this Maha Mantra. And Prabhupada would even say, I have no other cure. you know, just take this. This is Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Just take this Mahamantra. Just take it. It's Krishna in the form of his holy names. Easier to worship than the deity. The deity closes. You have to do this and you have to do that. Just take Krishna's holy names. Just take Krishna's holy names as your life and soul. So, what else can we say? This is what we've been given. The association of devotees, the holy names, the deities, the book, the Bhagavatam, and the holy dhams. These are the great gifts, but they all should be accompanied by the holy names. So then, the question is, what happens if you're too loopy to be able to do that even? So then one has to make gradual progress, and even you might have to take some things to straighten, you know, get some help that usually would take place in a culture, on a cultural level, so that you can do that to support the cultural support things. But the point is that we have to take shelter of Krishna's holy names and the book Bhagavatam and the, because what is the benefit of the book Bhagavatam and why is that so important? Because what does it do? It gives us a different kind of desire, because our material life is based on desire. Bhagavad Gita describes this in the 15th chapter, and this is what the material mode of passion does. It fills us with countless endless desires. So what we need to do is change our desiring from all this selfish, sensuous, etc., 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 to desire to serve Krishna because he's so wonderful.
How much do you need the association of devotees?
Yeah, without that, nothing happens.
You take something and then you go back out to the world where everybody seems to be the opposite way and it seems to disappear again.
Mm.
Because the massive effect of the propaganda of the current modern age.
It's heavy. So Bhaktivinoda Saraswati Thakur used to view the temples as forts, and they had big walls, and they were very strict about who went on inside and everything, because they were forts and the people needed to be protected. And these were young Indian brahmacharis who were so clean of heart compared to, you know, this was how many years ago? This was like 80 years ago. And there wasn't even any television then. There was just, you want to speak of the internet, what to speak of the movie theaters, and, huh?
Family.
That was the hardest thing they had to deal with, the family attachment. And the happiness born of, and the love born of that. So what to speak of today, how difficult it is, so how much more we need the holy names and the association of devotees and a lot of hearing and chanting and a lot of mercy, and that's what ultimately comes down to it. So that brings back to that question, we need so much mercy, okay, so what, is there anything I can do that can because mercy is causeless. What can I do that can attract causeless mercy? So I do my part. Mercy is, we can't force it. So do what we can, and desire as best we can. Any other questions or comments in the midst of all this? How does this look from the point of view of this topic, from the point of view of someone who's grown up in Bombay?
One thing, what Maharaj was saying was very attractive, kind of, not attractive, but it's a fact, kind of, like every person is in covered depression because he's trying to be someone who he is not because of lack of information what he actually is as a spiritual soul. So that's like, I would say, like life of Bombay, everybody's struggling to become rich, to become important person, as Maharaj was pointing out, because they really don't understand or they don't have that knowledge.
And they're feeling lack of being anything significant. Yeah.
In all big cities that's the situation. Still the smaller places are still different in that respect.
And the smaller places are becoming more and more empty because everyone moves to the cities. We saw this in Bangladesh. There's Rupsanathan Smriti Temple, I think it's called Rupsanathan Smriti. Fairly close to the place of Rupsanathan, between Kalna and Jeshur. This Kalna has a big temple in the Hindu area. And it's Vishnuraj basically built that temple. And it's in the midst of like 74 Hindu villages. And it was, and the road there was about this big. The only road there,
and we went by van.
Van means a rickshaw where you have to sit in the back. You couldn't drive a car there or anything like that. And there was just a little bit of electricity just starting to come there, and the place was so peaceful. It was shocking. I remember being shocked at how peaceful it was. And the people were like vibrating on a different level of peace. And it was so amazing. And there was one television in the village. And all the people, I don't know how often the television, there was a show on, but we were just watching them put it on a big stand. Like that, and everyone sitting there like this. And they'd be watching all these shows from Dhaka, right? And you can see how the young people seeing this big city and everything on the television. I didn't think, just as you were saying, that this is so boring here in this village. And the people were so nice and so friendly, and you could just wander around. And it was so peaceful, it was incredible. And you could see that because of that one television, you know, the next generation, they're going to go to Dhaka and try to find life. And then in Dhaka, there's all you could do is become a rickshawwala. So they leave this peace, incredible deep peace. They have land, you know, there's obviously a struggle to live and to grow things and mosquitoes and this and that and this and that, of course. But they leave that incredible peace, which breeds happiness, to go to Dhaka and become one of the 10 million rickshawwalas. And we used to, remember we used to watch how they didn't, rickshaws have this, I don't know how it is in Vrindavan exactly, but I never saw it anywhere else. But they have, there's so many of them, and they have less cars, at least they did in Dhaka. So, and the rickshaws, they had momentum, they had weight, but they didn't have brakes, and it wasn't easy for them to stop. So the way that they would stop was when there would be a red light or something. So the way they would stop is bang into the rickshaw in front of them. So invariably, you know, you're there, the rickshaw is there, and then some rickshaw, you're in the rickshaw, and the rickshaw is bangs, and some rickshaw comes and bangs into you and jars you completely, and then the rickshaw would turn around and yell at the person, "Well, why did you do that?" And then, but 2 minutes later, some rickshaw banged into the one who just banged into you, like that, and he would turn around and, "Why did you do that?" And then someone would bang into him. And it was just a series of tortures in the city, basically, because of the inflaming of all the desires.
cows become criminals and they
don't have any way to get money.
They don't have jobs, they don't have money, so they become criminals.
Feed thieves.
Feed, even murders. Everything that they can do, gangs, steal cars, steal things, kill other people.
So like there's a figure of how many producers tell me how many people move to Bombay every day from the villages. That's every day. And there's people who wait for the young girls who come, who don't have any, they just come there and they don't know what to do. They say, you want to be a movie star? Come. And then they trap them.
Yeah.
So it's Kali Yuga.
When you're going on the train, they track the TT. I found this one time, he said, where do you come from? He said, Australia. He said, oh. He said, every year in Australia is born in India.
That's a population group.
Mm. Every year.
There's as many people in Australia as Delhi.
Yeah.
Delhi's got 10 million people now. That's not even with Noida probably and Gurgaon and all these other surrounding places.
The struggle for resistance has always been there, but it is more intense now in this because people's desires have flourished.
Isn't it odd that the struggle for resistance is so much more intense?
Yeah.
And it's trying to attain and it's like just in their grasp, but it's so much more intensely attracted and stimulated than in the past. Both of them have gone up radically.
But the struggle for existence is so much more difficult. As you were saying, how about getting food in Bombay? So expensive. How much is rice?
Rice is something 40, 50 rupees. Yeah.
But what were the things that really?
The fruits. Like fruits. If you want apple, they're like 350, 400 rupees a kg. Grapes are 700 rupees a kg. So it's like $20.
Yeah, the cost of living is increasing very rapidly and
very
unhappy.
And still you say, are we making progress? And everyone will say, yes, we're making progress. Before we didn't have the internet, we didn't have television, we didn't have, now we have satellite dishes and we can get 200 television stations. We're making progress. Of course, we can't even afford to eat anymore, but anyway, we're making progress. We can eat virtual food. Did you say that computer game, they call it Farm something? Yeah. What they do is they have this computer game because people are longing for a simple life. So what they do is they have these computer games where you buy produce, tractors, and you have some acres of land, and then virtually you plant things, and then after some days it harvests and you can sell it, and you get back some of the money, and then you have to invest in seeds, and you take real money, you know, like this. And it's insane. Instead of like farming, it's all in the mind, just like you said. It's crazy. And people do these things, you know, that they're very wealthy demons, you know. Yeah, just everyone's living in their mind. No one wants to live where they're living.
And who's the one of the foremost in IT?
Me?
India.
Sure, how great.
We're going to catch up. We're going to be number one. We will show them. Haribol.
So
unfortunate.
So it's so great that they're greatly unfortunate.
Another thing which Maharaj said was very kind of, I think, because basically the way culture was before was neighbors were like talking about their own. And even when I grew up, I know like I was hardly ever at my own place.
Yes.
Because we were like on the floors, like there were 15 rooms.
Yeah.
Some kind of So we were growing like we were practically always at someone neighbor's house.
Yeah.
Even lunch or dinner we used to have at their place.
Yeah.
Only to sleep we used to come back.
Yeah.
And parents never knew, like, they knew we were on the same floor, but which room or whose neighbor's place, they never knew that. So that was a...
There was such, so much affection. But now it just rests on the husband and the wife to bring up a child. It's so difficult.
Mm.
So difficult. It's completely unnatural. There's no family around. Because, you know, the children, they always need to be, they always need attention. Security and affection. So it all rests on, you know, one person, the mother, you know, to do it. So then, and then the father has to work all day long. So then he comes back and she says, "You have to take him now. It's so hard for me. He's just been in work all day long." And, you know, just so everything is together. Everyone amazingly is convinced it's getting better. It's progress.
And you put them into school too, because if you put them into school too, they will also be really well trained up for the same competitive lifestyle. Plus, you have your free time.
No, free time. No, they work.
And you can go to work as well.
And that's what has to happen. The husband and wife, I don't know about India so much, but both work in the West so much now.
Okay.
Did you say the grandparents?
Yeah.
Oh Lord, Hare Krishna. So anyway, I don't know if we just missed our evening instead of talking about Krishna, but it has a different flavor, this type of preaching, than talking about Krishna directly, doesn't it?
Prabhupada would do this too. Remember, he would come to the class, he would do a very, very, very profound Bhagavatam class, and he would all nod a bit, and try to stay awake. And then he would sit in an informal way in his room, if you had the good fortune to get into his room. And he would start talking about all the anomalies.
Yeah.
Everyone would come alive. You're not going to have milk here anymore. You make it out of coconut milk.
Yeah.
Just see. So you get another one. Just see. And it's the only way we could actually contribute something was to talk about the madness that we had access to. And then he would go from place to place and share those things as part of his presentation. My students have told me. In odd way we were able to contribute.
Okay. Good night. Hare Krishna. Tomorrow we go back to hearing about Krishna willing.